Chapman, and you're listening to Beyond the Box Podcast.
Hi, I'm Rayburn Johnson.
And I'm Steve Sensenig.
And this is Beyond the Box.
Here's your invitation to explore life outside the box of institutional religion.
This is a place where there are no walls to restrict our search for truth as we embrace the ambiguity of defining our life in Christ.
So unbuckle your seatbelt,
recline your chair,
throw caution to the wind, and get ready for the ride that is
Beyond the Box. Happy 2013, everyone, and welcome back to Beyond the Box. It is great to be back with you in a new year with some exciting new guests, some exciting new topics, and I just can't wait to see what this year brings. And the fact that I'm standing here must prove either that I survived the Mayan apocalypse or that I've been left behind. But either way, I'm really tickled to be back with you today. Today, I am joined by a special guest on a very important topic, talking about a very, very important book that I think each of us that's interested in Christian nonviolence should go out and get. This book is entitled A Faith Not Worth Fighting For, addressing commonly asked questions about Christian nonviolence. And today I'm joined by the co-editor, Dr. Tripp York. Now, Tripp has, he just is such a fun guy to talk to. I had a great time in this podcast. I could have stayed on the Skype call for several more hours picking his brain and just enjoying his time. But I tell you, I just really think you're going to get a lot out of this podcast. This book has about 12 or 13 different contributors, and they all are talking about some of the most difficult questions posed to Christian pacifists. These are questions like, well, what would you do about Hitler? Or what do you do if someone's attacking your family? Or one that's really been raised on the Facebook page here recently, and one that I've personally struggled with a lot, is what about the use of the police? Is it okay for someone who believes in Christian nonviolence to call the police? Or are we simply outsourcing our violence to someone else? There's so many good questions in this book, and there's contributors, people like Greg Boyd, people like Andy Alexis Baker, of course, Tripp York. There's just so many good people. I know Stanley Hauerwasser wrote the foreword, Shane Claiborne wrote the afterword. This book is, I believe, one of the two or three most important books I've read on Christian nonviolence. And if you're either a Christian pacifist or you're simply interested in the subject, I really think that you need to do yourself a favor and pick up this book. I know I encourage you to get a lot of books on this podcast, but if you're at all interested in Christian nonviolence, in my mind, this is a must read. So anyway, I'm going to get out of the way in a moment. I just want to apologize first off. For some reason, Tripp and I were having a problem with our Skype connection. And so you'll notice a few times where for some reason, we can't hear what he's saying. And you'll notice that I'm quiet a lot while Tripp's talking. And it's simply because when I would speak, for some reason, it was cutting off his mic. So please bear with some of the technical difficulties that we had. But I tell you what, if you'll put those earbuds in or pop us into your MP3 player or however you listen to us, I think you're really, really going to enjoy this conversation, and it's going to spur a lot of discussion. So without further ado, here is Tripp York talking about A Faith Not Worth Fighting For. Well, welcome back to Beyond the Box, everyone. I am tickled to be joined by a fellow North Carolinian today. Yes, they make lots of good things in North Carolina. Pepsi, Michael Jordan, the Carolina Panthers, and I will add Tripp York to that list of good things. Thank Tripp, you. It is great to have you on the podcast, brother.
Thank you. My mother, who is a diehard Tar Heels fan, will appreciate that reference to Michael Jordan. And even though I'm a Dookie, so last night warmed my heart when they were beat by UVA. So, but she'll still appreciate that.
Here I am. I can't believe I just started and I've already made the faux pas. I've got a graduate of Duke, and I'm sitting here talking about Michael Jordan. That's probably not the best foot to get off on.
No, that's good. He was stellar.
Well, you've written several books, which we're gonna on a later episode go over your newest book, The Devil Wears Nada. But today we want to talk about a book that you helped co-edit with a guy named Justin Bronson Berenger, entitled "A Faith Not Worth Fighting For." And I know I've told you, Tripp, before we got on the air that we have talked a tremendous about nonviolence on this podcast, and I have to say that of all the books I've read, this book does probably the best job of just giving people really good abbreviated answers to all of the really hard questions. And what I'd like to do today is, you've got 13 chapters, I think, in this book. We're going to pick about 5 of these questions and really go a little in depth on them, and just kind of let people hear what the other questions are, so that we can definitely get people to get this book. Because I know I'm always saying a book is good, you guys out in listening land, but this is a book that if you've been interested in nonviolence, you got to get your hands on. A Faith Not Worth Fighting For. You are, of course, being a Duke man, a Howard-Wassian.
Yes,
and I want to kick this off. Go ahead.
That's true, although I try not to tell many people that. Because it gets you in a lot of trouble. He'll even say that. He's like, don't tell people you know me. I'm like, all right, Stanley. I won't do it.
Well, I think with this crowd, you're going to fit right in.
All right, good.
I want to kick off with a quote that you guys actually started the book out with. It says, "Christian nonviolence is not so much a position, but rather a declaration that requires ongoing reflection," from Howard Wass. And I'm noticing that one of the things that people really have had a hard time with, as we've talked about nonviolence, is it almost seems like we're creating this almost a belief system that's an ideal within itself, that that almost the faith becomes about nonviolence instead of kind of a declaration of, you know, I'm a disciple of Jesus, and part of being a disciple of Jesus is to hold to nonviolence. How do you kind of separate these things out and keep from kind of bowing beneath a construct of pacifism, and instead looking at pacifism kind of in the whole of Christian discipleship?
Yeah, and I guess one of the ways that you think about that, and I guess that why that quote's so helpful, is that when he's saying that nonviolence isn't a position, what that does is it privileges something. And so this is an odd way for Christians to start talking about things, because the assumption is that there's some sort of definition of what constitutes violence, and then whatever nonviolence is, it ends up, you know, being defined by either what violence is or against it, or what it's not, or whatever. And so, you know, one of the things that I've often tried to say in a number of different places is that the whole crux of understanding Christian nonviolence is to first relinquish the notion that there's some sort of theory that develops as a response to something called violence, because then that privileges violence and says, hey, this is out there, and therefore how do I respond to it? Whereas what we want to say is that from the Christian way of life, rather we start from, you know, the witness and the teachings of Jesus and go from that, and things are positioned against the witness and the reality of Jesus, rather than us trying to position our discipleship against these other sort of so-called realities that we think are parasitic off of the life of Jesus. As Augustine would say, you know, you have the kingdom of God, the city of God, and even the best good on earth is still parasitic off of that city. So even Augustine, you know, really the father of the just war tradition, doesn't want to privilege violence by any means first. And so we always like to start out by changing the subject to say, let's not privilege something called violence. It's actually privileged the life and teachings of Jesus and what that means for us to bear witness to that reality. And that will actually maybe change the conversation in such a way that we can end up some places where we otherwise may not end up. And so I think that's why, and of course, Howard Wass is getting this from Yoder, to which he will, you know, openly admit, you know, Howard Wass is, you know, someone once referred to one of my books as sort of a hack job, the Living on Hope book. They're like, you know, York is a hack. And I'm like, of course I'm a hack. You know, it's not a matter whether I'm going to be a hack. It's just who I'm going to hack from. And and I got that from Stanley, who got that from Yoder, you know, and this whole sort of tradition of just sort of hacking, which that's what makes a tradition. But that was Yoder's thing. Nonviolence, or if you want to call it Christian pacifism, is not a position that someone just sort of adopts. That's created as a response to violence, rather instead of this sort of philosophical premise It's more just sort of a way of life by which everything else is positioned around that. I don't know if that was a helpful response, but that's
start. That actually is a really helpful response, because I think so many times, Tripp, it seems like the real temptation for Christians is to let ourselves be defined by what we're against, instead of it's almost like we need an enemy for self-identification.
Yes, yeah. Instead of being defined by what we're for, we end up being defined by what we're against, which makes us very complicit in the very thing, because our life ends up being reactionary. So even in some of my circles of good Christian anarchist friends, they're far more defined by what they're opposed to, whether it's the nation state or the violence implicated by imperialism, rather than being defined by what they're for, which is the Eucharist. You know, the Eucharist, participation in the Eucharist and the Eucharistic life is what makes us, rather than having these sort of realities out there. You know, here's these bad things happening and I'm opposed to them. So how do I respond? And so it leads you to different places and different ways of thinking about those places. I think maybe more faithful to how we look at Scripture and how we not only interpret Scripture, but how Scripture interprets us, so to speak.
It seems like it almost, you know, I know we're going on a little bit of a bunny trail here, but I'll just go ahead and tell you, as I tell most people, we actually own the domain rabbittrailpodcast.com. So if that tells you anything.
Quite well, then.
But, you know, it seems like the whole idea of the ethic of Jesus of, you know, love of God and love of neighbor, which especially includes the enemy, that when we do allow ourselves to be defined by violence and we become reactionary, that we almost are undermining the very thing that we're called to, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the whole notion of, and it's very difficult in this culture. I don't know if you've read much of Zizek, but Zizek talks much about how our lives and our culture has been defined by protest. And protest itself is inscripted in the order. It's needed and required for people to live the kind of lives they think they need to live, but it ends up sort of buttressing the very thing they're opposed to. You know, could Democrats or liberals really exist in this world without Republicans or conservatives? I don't know if they could, because their position is completely defined by what they're opposed to. If one side was to drop off the planet, which both sides want, I don't know how they would exist, because then they'd have to figure out what they actually, you know, are standing for, as opposed to what they're sort of standing against. And the thing you mentioned a moment ago about, you know, what it means to love our neighbors and love our enemies, and I've always thought, you know, the most interesting thing about Jesus was the fact that he gave people a new way to deal with their enemies, you know, to forgive them, to love them. And, At best, you know, many churches may give that lip service, but it's rarely in any sort of interesting way by which I think it's clear that Jesus meant it. I think Jesus actually meant it. And instead, I want to say we spent about the last 1,600 years figuring out how to circumvent that commandment and to get around it, which at the heart of most of everything that he was really saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that really ties into something that you and Justin say in the intro. And this is something I've noticed. Brian McLaren really hit on this in his newest book as well, about why Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad crossed the road, was the idea that our violence is driven more by our love than by our hate. And it's out of our many loves that violence so often becomes a great temptation, because we want to protect our loved ones, our families, our friends, ourselves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
McLaren has obviously read some Hauerwas too, because that is a very Hauerwasian comment. I mean, he's very adamant to say in his courses and stuff, you know, we often kill not because of what we hate, we kill because of what we love. And he spends a lot of time talking about love and disordered accounts of love. He actually has a sermon in his book Unleashing the Scriptures, Hating Mothers as a Way to Peace, which is an interesting sermon where he talks about this. And McLaren could be getting that from going back as far as Augustine, who understood, you know, this, we resort to violence for love of others, as opposed to just, I hate this and I'm going to respond to it. And so that is the, as Howard would say, that's sort of one of the greatest temptations, And it's why folks like John Milbank disagree vehemently with Hauerwas, because Milbank and company are going to argue that that temptation to do harm for the sake of others is a natural inclination of what it means to be human, to protect one another, to protect the least of these, etc. Hauerwas, in response, wants to talk about how that may be a natural inclination, but what does the incarnation of God in Jesus, how does that deal with... I mean, we have a ton of natural inclinations that we probably shouldn't follow up on. I mean, that's what really gets us in trouble. But you know, it's a very interesting point. And of course, the question is never not how do we intervene? Because a lot of people on this subject, especially folks who are sort of offended morally by something like nonviolence, those who practice think that you're not somehow not interventionist, that we're somehow just passive. You know, that's why I don't even use pacifism, because it's so much like pacifism. We're very much about intervening, not only helping those we love, but helping those we don't even know. We're just trying to not do it in such a way that doesn't bear the witness of Christ. And so that's really tricky, and it requires a lot of creativity, and far more creativity than simply just carrying a gun and shooting and hoping for the best. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that actually leads right into your first chapter and I'm going to probably murder some of these people's names, speaking of violence, but Rosalie Veloso.
Yes.
Yule? Is that right?
Exactly. Yule.
She started out with the first chapter, isn't pacifism passive? And this is something that I've gotten over and over again. Aren't you just, isn't that more about passivity than about action, and therefore it's not really loving your neighbor? But she brought up something I thought was really fascinating, was the definition of passive, and that it originally meant one who suffers, which really leads right into the Passion of Christ and the idea that Jesus set the example. He didn't just suffer on our behalf, but he set the example that we also should suffer like him. So it doesn't really mean not doing anything, but it's rather doing something creative. Can you talk about that, and maybe how we can begin to think in these creative ways?
Yeah, to Rosalie's credit, that was such a strong, because I honestly wasn't even thinking about going that way. Because for me, I'm, you know, I'd asked her, I said, I'd really like for you to approach this question, and if you would, and she was like, sure, absolutely, and my whole explanation was to just drop the word passive, you know, because I was still suffering from that, not doing anything, because my first gut instinct is when someone says, oh, I guess passive is just sit back in a corner not doing anything, and I'm like, really? Ever heard of somebody named Martin Luther King Jr., you know, or how about Gandhi? He trumped the entire British Empire. You know, there is nothing passive about Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., at least in terms of how this has been used. Or look at the Berrigan brothers. I mean, their entire lives were filled with activity. The most active guys you'd ever meet, Dorothy Day. And so that was my approach of, like, we have just countless examples of pacifists or anything but sitting in a corner, you know, hoping for the nation state to keep them safe and sound. And then she comes up with this and says, well, actually, if we talk about this word, maybe there's a sense in which, you know, as she points out, one who suffers. Well, my goodness, that sounds a lot like, you know, not only Jesus, but the prophets that became before Jesus, and then Jesus, and then all the disciples that came right after him. And since Jesus, you know, said, you know, if the world hated me and the world persecuted me, then, you know, they will do the same to you, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to fall sort of right in line. And so she is just one more example of a lot of people in the book that really subvert what you thought the question was while you were asking it, which leads you to some answers that may not be terribly, you know, faithful answers. And I thought that was just such a genius move on her part to very sort of like, well, let's actually talk about this language. And I thought that was very helpful, while at the same time saying yes. And of course, no one in, you know, that I know of who practice or attempt to practice Christian nonviolence would ever just say we're just gazing, you know, again, to go back to John Milbank, and for those out there listening who want a really strong critique of Christian pacifism, John Milbank gives a really good one in his book Being Reconciled, which is an incredible book. And because his worry is always of sort of having the spectator kind of gaze. But, you know, Milbank lives in ivory towers. He's not out there with Christian peacemaking teams seeing actual people put their bodies between tanks and other people. So, of course, he writes things like that because he doesn't know any better. And we've called him out on those things. And to his credit, it's, you know, one of those kind of guys that you can have a good conversation with about. Matter of fact, he wrote the foreword for another one of my books. Although it was put out and published by an Anabaptist publisher, and it was funny because he wrote the foreword, but he still took a shot at us in the foreword to our book, which is sort of collateral bank style. But yeah, absolutely.
That's really cool. I will definitely have to check that out because I've been hearing so many, you know, the arguments that I've heard against Christian nonviolence, they're all based on a practical level. And I get that, you know, I get the idea that practically, this makes absolutely no sense. But what we're talking about is not about, you know, utilitarianism or practicality. It's about faithfulness to Jesus. And so, yeah, I'm going to have to read something by a person that actually takes that serious.
and that's all we've kind of asked for people in this book. You know, those of us who are in the Christian nonviolence tradition, and someone like Stanley Hauerwas, who's lectured at West Point, you know, and John Howard Yoder, Paul Ramsey once said about John Howard Yoder that he would rather have John Howard Yoder teaching just war than anyone else because John Howard Yoder understood just war. And so those people in my camp have spent, you know, so much of their lives studying just war theory or Niebuhrian Christian realism, yet nobody's doing the return favor and studying, you know, sort of the best of what we have to offer. And so part of the idea of the book is we offer as a means of hospitality, saying if not only is it a resource for those who want to practice nonviolence, but for those who are looking for a good opposition to positions of just war and stuff, that maybe they'll take this kind of book at least seriously. But one other book I should tell you, if you're interested in that, Milbank, there's a conversation between Milbank and Hauerwas in a book called Must Christianity Be Violent? And a conversation between them two, sort of very much going at it on this best leaders of Milbank, who's sometimes reeks of Christian realism, and then of course Stanley Hauerwas, and it's a great conversation that I recommend between them two for sure.
You know, in the second chapter, this seems to be where the rubber really hits the road for a lot of people. The name of this chapter, and I love the names of the chapters because they just put it right out there at the beginning. Here's the hard question. Let's dive in. This one's, what about the protection of third-party innocence? And the next part, this is really going to raise the dander of a lot of people, on Letting Your Neighbor Die by Stephen Long. And in that chapter, you got to love that, on Letting Your Neighbor Die. Let's just lay our cards on the table and let the chips fall where they may. He starts the chapter out by saying, the protection of third-party innocence is probably the strongest possible defense of Christian participation in violence and war. And then he says, the central question posed to pacifists is not, are we willing to die, but rather, are we willing to let others die for our convictions? The most difficult aspect of pacifism is not that we might lose our own lives, but that we might lose those of the ones we would want to defend. Can you speak to this, Tripp? And this question is, over and over, this is the question I probably have heard more than anything else, because at the end of the day, most people are willing to recognize the claims of Jesus upon their own life and read the Sermon on the Mount and go, I can see that this is the way that he's calling me to live. And yet, when it comes to whether it be our families, our friends, or other innocent people, it seems that we use that as kind of an out for that call to faithful discipleship in the way of Jesus. Tell us what your take on this is.
Absolutely. And Steve is a great guy. He was actually my dissertation advisor. He was my PhD advisor. And terrific guy. And that was one of those that I was adamant. I was like, I want you to take a shot at this one because I'd heard him speak about it so much. And the subtitle that he gave there on Letting Your Neighbors Die was very intentional for a number of reasons because, again, one of the assumptions that's made is that one of the chief problems of nonviolence or pacifism is the fact that as you stated, it's one thing if I have a conviction that causes that may be a result in my death. It's another if it results in someone else's. Now, of course, the sort of genius move that he makes is, so how is that any different than just war theory? How is that any different than Christian realism? Any conviction that's worth having may not only ask that you die, but it may ask that others die. And no one has ever asked that more heartily than the warrior. I mean, that's exactly what there's not a war that goes on where there's not just killing of enemies and killing of one another, but non-combatants are always not necessarily targeted, just like a pacifist doesn't necessarily intend for someone's death, but it's just going to happen. So the one thing that just warriors and Christian realists and practitioners of Christian violence all share is the possibility that someone may suffer for our convictions. And there's no different than anyone who picks up the rifle or the sword or whatever. It's absolutely no different at all. So in that case, he sets that out there and tries to clear that and say, let's talk about the morality of these positions then and say they're kind of on the same playing field there. And it talks again about how, but this is the crux, it's, as Paul Ramsey said, and again, for those out there who want to read good just war theorists, and I always recommend, I like to recommend the best people writing in Christian nonviolence and the best people writing in just war. I don't like to set up straw men or straw women. Paul Ramsey is absolutely hands down one of the best theorists and makes one of the best cases for just war you can find. And of course, Ramsey's whole take is on this very thing where Ramsey says, yes, Jesus tells you to turn the other cheek, but Jesus does not tell you to turn your neighbor's cheek, kind of thing. And of course, this was the very thing that got Augustine as well, and Augustine, by the way, was not an advocate for self-defense. He very much thought that if someone were personally attacking you, then you have to take the path of Christ in that regard and absorb the evil, so to speak. But of course, what got Augustine is, well, what do I do when I see it happening to others, kind of thing. And the reason we place them back to back at the first chapter is to say, but the pacifist isn't just sitting by. The pacifist doesn't want to see their neighbors die by any mean whatsoever. Now, the good Christian pacifist realizes that there are things worse than death. And the one thing worse than death, of course, for the good Christian is disobedience to Jesus. And so it very well may be the case that I or someone else dies for those convictions. But that doesn't mean that you're just going to stand by and sort of let something happen. It just means you're going to have a more creative approach that may or may not be as successful as, taking up the sword. You mentioned a few moments ago that the life discipleship as a whole, not just nonviolence, but as a whole is not judged by how practical it is. It's not judged by its pragmatism or its utilitarianism by any means. As John Howard Yoder says, the cross has nothing to do in following Jesus has nothing to do with effectiveness. It just has to do with obedience. But at the same time, sometimes it is practical. Sometimes it is pragmatic. Again, Gandhi got rid of the British, and Martin Luther King Jr. was quite successful in many ways by not taking the approach about it. So it can be. But it's not necessarily judged by that by any means whatsoever, primarily because we see what happened to Jesus and we see what happened, to his disciples. And so are we going to look like that? And I guess my question there is, the question is, would Jesus attempt to disarm others who were harming, his neighbors? I think so. And I think he would have done it in a very creative way. I think it's important that Peter and company, to quote Howard Weiss, when Jesus was being, about to be crucified, that Peter and company didn't go and, create the Galilean Liberation Front. I mean, here's a classic case of an innocent suffering a great injustice. Yet I don't foresee how it would have been possible for his followers to think, we got to liberate this guy. And I don't think Jesus by any means would have advocated that sort of thing. So it may ask that others die, but I'm pretty sure that's what Jesus demands of us. since he tells us to die to ourselves. And I guess part of it goes back to, I've always been curious as to why, after 2,000 years of Christianity, we all still think we're going to get out of this alive. And that still just baffles me, because that's sort of the, you know, the one thing that I think we have to take a look at, and I'm not someone who wants to be a martyr by any means. I don't mind, you know, dying at a ripe old age. That sounds good to me. But is this emphasis we place on security and our own personal well-being. And I'm like, I guess as long as you don't read the Gospels, you can think that's possible. But what read the Gospels or read the book of Revelation and think that that is first and foremost on Jesus's mind, because I don't think he's terribly concerned with that at all.
Certainly, you know, safety. You know, the chapter by Robert Brimlow on What About Hitler, he really brings out, which I just thought, you know, I thought that was just a great point, was, you know, he really brings out this idea that it's going to be completely impractical, that's not the question. The question is, are you being obedient to Jesus? Because it's like you said, we're going to die one way or the other, but do you want to die being obedient to Jesus, or in whatever the ramifications of that are, or do you want to die, you know, in disobedience?
Well, and I think one of the most telling things that Reinhold Niebuhr ever said, and he does this in his book, Christianity and Power Politics, and you have to realize that even for those who are listening who have never read Niebuhr, he's been one of the most influential Christian thinkers of the 20th century. I mean, you know, he's the last theologian to, who was on the cover of Time magazine, you know, back in, maybe in the 50s. I mean, he's on the cover of Time magazine. There wasn't a seminary in the United States that wasn't reading Reinhold Niebuhr. Very, very influential. And he talks about... and he was talking about this. He did this during World War II as well, when he was talking about the Mennonites, where he actually says, and he's talking about the Amish and the Mennonites, and, you know, they're not going in supporting World War II, which, you know, if there's ever a just war, you know, that's one of them. And he actually says, you know, I think what groups like the Amish and Mennonites do, are it's incredible, because they take Jesus seriously, they take him literally, they attempt to follow him, you know, to the letter, but at the end of the day, it's just not practical. And he says that, and what he's saying is, he's like, the teachings of Jesus are not practical for living in the real world. And that's Niebuhr in Christianity and Power Politics. You can't look at those passages on the Sermon on the Mount and think that you can be a responsible, practical citizen and act follow those, and that is the most important Christian thinker of the 20th century, and that's exactly what he was arguing. And so you're like, well, no wonder we have such a hard time getting a hearing. You know, I mean, when he himself just says, yeah, you know, good for them taking Jesus seriously, but do you want to be a responsible person in the world? If you want to be, that's why anytime you hear a politician talk, use the word responsible, look out, because you're about to be owned. And you're about to be owned by the principalities and powers. Once you hear that thing about the responsible thing to do, you're about to get it. You're about to be.
Amen. 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 The thing I kind of lost my train of thought there for a second, but the Brimlow, what he was saying in that part that I really wanted to hit on and get your take on, was this idea that our number one goal in the nation state, that what we've been taught is our number one, not only priority, but our number one right, is that of self-preservation and self-defense. And that really, when the nation state emerged, that what we did is we just basically, we turned our responsibility for our own self-preservation, our own self-defense, we carpooled, so to speak, and threw everybody in the same car and said, okay, we're going to have an army, we're going to have a police force, we're going to do all these things to protect our right of self-preservation. And so the number one right that we've been, especially in America, brought up with is our freedoms. The idea that we have rights and freedoms that no one else should be able to take away from us, and that should be protected at any cost. And so when we come up against that, as Christians, it seems like we've been taught, and maybe this is because of things like the moral majority or the religious right, that we've been, you know, taught that we should take back our freedoms as Christians, and we should, you know, get into politics and all these kinds of things to make sure that we protect our right to be Christians, so to speak. which immediately seems to undermine the very essence of the countercultural anarchistic dynamic that was inherent in Christianity, at least the Christianity of Jesus. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and a little bit before you aired, we were talking a little bit about Lee Camp, his book Mere Disciple. And he recently wrote another book, Who's Your Enemy, or something to that effect. I can't recall, but he got into a bit of trouble because in an interview, he said something about the necessity for Christians to just let go. They need to just let go. And people thought this to mean that he wanted them to let go of their convictions and things like that. And he's like, no. He said, I think it's because of our convictions that we're able to let go trying to control the world, because it's not up to us to control the world. If we believe what we say we believe about the cross and resurrection, things are already going to move in a certain direction regardless of what we do. Empires come, empires go. Revelation lays it out there. You know, the best empire is still Babylon that's going to fall. And so part of what it means is to get rid of this Constantinian temptation to run things. And in our culture, as you notice, the highest goal, the telos, the one thing that we have more faith in than anything is this abstract concept of freedom, this ability to just, you know, have this right to basically what that means is to be able to purchase whatever we want to purchase. We'll defend that at any means necessary. Anyone who threatens that is the enemy. And it is a curious thing because you don't find that in Jesus, especially since he's telling you to be a slave to one another. You certainly don't get the language of rights until another, like, 1600 years after Jesus. And so what you have is a culture that's far more owned by the philosophical teachings of John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, and Immanuel Kant, even though most of these people have never read them, who really instilled these things and said part of what it means to have a successful nation state is you have to guarantee certain rights, inalienable rights, to people, and they started calling them God-given rights, although you can't show me a text in the Bible that ever says God says you have the right to buy as many DVDs as you want. Own a 3,800-square-foot house, and if you need to buy my Iraqis to own it, then so be it. You know, you're not going to find that text.
Preach.
it's just sort of baffling how Christians, especially North America, have given up on this notion that the church is a nation. The nation state is just one more little philosophical project that's just going to fall to the wayside. And why Christians ever got in their heads that there's something worth completely annihilating, you know, the convictions of the Sermon on the Mount to perpetuate a nation state. It's impressive. It's impressive how we got to that point. And it was a very, very long history. To sort of get to that point, get to that era. But I feel you really have to just sort of ignore the prophets and their teachings as well as Jesus's to make those leaps to this idolatry of freedom and what that means.
Wow. That's, you know, I think that's always the of all the questions that come up, though, that has to be the biggest one about the protection of innocence. Because, you know, I've got two little boys. I've got a three-year-old. Actually, I've got 2 3-year-olds now. My son just turned 3 this week. So I've got 2 3-year-olds right now. And, you know, nobody wants to see their family die. The thing that we hear over and over again is, what about kids? And, you know, what about your wife and all these kinds of things, which really leads into the next question in chapter 3. Which I have to say, the two ladies, I'm not familiar with the two ladies that you had to do this chapter, but my goodness, this is great, great stuff. The question is, what would you do if someone were attacking a loved one? And this is Amy Laura Hall and Kara Slade. And I thought, Tripp, what they did in this chapter, by taking each part of that question apart, picking each word and really unmasking the layers of meaning under each word, was absolute brilliance. First of all, they were bringing up the idea, which was very, very much in line with John Howard Yoder, that so many times what we're doing is we're only leaving the possibility open that we either have a successful attempt at killing someone or that we die. We don't leave the option open at all. And Steve and I on the podcast have talked about this a lot, that we never leave the option open that the Holy Spirit could actually show up, could give us something from heaven that would either result in a miracle happening or that he would give us the grace to die as a witness to our enemy. So that part wasn't new to me, and that part's not going to be new to our listeners. But the thing that really blew me away, and I think part of this is because I am a white, American, middle-class, privileged man who has never had to think through these things. Things like rape. Things like what it means to a woman to hear a man say, "What if someone attacked your family and raped your wife?" And it's so interesting how these ladies brought into the conversation the idea that rape always seems to make its way into this discussion. They begin to go into the early history of rape, how it was seen as not just a crime against a person, but as against property.
Yes.
Can you kind of unpack some of this for us? Because to a lot of our listeners, I know to me, I just went, oh my goodness, I was absolutely floored. And to a lot of our listeners, this is going to be a really novel thing. Can you kind of unpack that for us and maybe talk about some of the implications of what these ladies are talking about?
Yeah, well, first of all, you were doing a pretty good job. And apparently you've read it more recently than I have. So maybe you should. But I mean, part of what they're doing, of course, is noting they were doing so many things in there. And again, so many things that were novel because, as you said, they started from that basic sort of premise that one of the things that John Howard ever did, and if you're a person who asked that question, what do you do if, he's got a tremendous book, which is called What Would You Do If?, which I think is fantastic. And one of the first things that he does is say, to follow Tolstoy, if all hypothetical questions should have hypothetical answers. You know, there's no way for determining what's going to happen. You know, things often, as Reinhold Niebuhr again himself said, you know, sometimes when you're trying to do good is when you do the most non-good. And that happens even in situations of self-defense. You end up bringing more harm than doing. You know, a lot of people just assume that, oh, if there was just somebody there with a gun, everything would have been better. You know, not at all. Reinhold Niebuhr wouldn't even let you think that. And so one of the things that they do that, again, they subvert the question is ask these kind of things. And, of course, showing how patriarchalism seeps into this over and thoroughly again about, you know, what would you do? And I like how Amy Laura Hall, I'm trying to recall the chapter, how she talks about, you know, it's an interesting thing. I'm all of 5'1", 150 pounds. So it's very unlikely that I'm going to be able to physically do a whole lot, you know. But as someone who tries to take Jesus seriously, I'm not sure if me, you know, purchasing a shotgun to protect my family is somehow in line with the radical nature of Jesus's call. But yet they bring that to light and they show how even questions like that end up doing so much violence, of course, to women. And again, as you note, you know, in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, and you see this clearly, I teach courses on sex and violence where the sin of rape is always the fact that male property had been damaged. And you see this very clearly with the rape of Tamar by her half-brother, Amnon. I think I'm getting the right brother. There's a couple of brothers there. I think that's correct. And what's very telling about that story is after Amnon rapes her, he sends her away. And she actually doesn't want to go. And she actually says that what you're doing now by sending me away is worse than the rape itself. Because being a product of her culture, once the property is damaged, which is what rape does in that thing, the woman has... And
we lost you there for just 1 second, Tripp. Can you say that sentence again?
Right, yeah. And again, this is sort of where patriarchalism just rears its ugly head in sort of ancient Israelite culture and in the Hebrew Bible. This again, the woman had lost all value, and Amnon was wasted. I mean, Tamar was wasted goods by this point, which is why, you know, in the Old Testament, if you raped a woman, as long as you married her, it was okay and it was forgiven. And so part of what they do there is they sort of uncover this long history of how we still fall into the immediate, what if someone was raping your wife? You know, and you're like, that's a really interesting thing. Why was that the first thing you came up with? Like, what drives, what sort of inherent violence do we have toward one another and what it means to be male and female is underwriting that question in the first place. It's very interesting that that's sort of your first question. And I think they do an interesting thing of unplugging that. And I don't know if I should give away where they come with, because I think, as you said, it's one of the most innovative chapters. And it's been one of the most controversial chapters. When people have reviewed the book, that's always the chapter that people are like either going, wow, or one reviewer was like, it was the most useless chapter in the whole book, to which Kara wrote, well, I'm glad, because we didn't mean it to be utilitarian-based. We don't think Christianity is utilitarian-based. So the fact that you pejoratively deemed it useless, we think, is actually a positive.
I have to say, Tripp, this chapter, I don't know. This is something I've had to be, I guess, unplugged from the matrix myself on, is, you know, the idea that, because, once again, you and I as, you know, white American men who have been privileged and haven't had to go through some of these things, we don't see the inherent violence in things like racism and rape and all of these kinds of things. And just the idea that we're men and are never looked at as property, but we've, white middle-class American men, have always been the property owners. We've never been owned. We always are the owners. And so, yeah, I'm like you. I don't want to completely give this away, because it's so, people should buy the book for this chapter alone, in my opinion.
A very deliberate decision. Amy Laura Hall is worth checking out. She has a book called Conceiving Parenthood that's really good. And if you want to find somebody that's really spunky and sassy, I don't know if she'd appreciate me calling her spunky, I'm going to tell her that. But if you want a little bit about who she is, a couple of years ago she did this thing called the Billionaire's Toast at Duke University. She's become a very big thorn in the flesh to some of the folks at Duke, which has an all-star cast of faculty and stuff. But it was a couple of years ago when all the higher-ups at Duke, despite the turn of the economy and folks with more manual labor-based jobs, they're getting the can. A lot of the privilege at Duke still found ways to give themselves anywhere from $300,000 to $1 million bonuses. It's all I can say is, if you go to YouTube and pull up Billionaire's Toast, Amy Laura Hall, you will see some holy hell being given. And it's classic.
But my kind of lady.
And when you see her and then you read it, you really hear that sort of coming through there.
One of the things that they talked about in this chapter too, just a couple quick points, and I want people to really read it, is the idea that the whole idea of someone attacking your loved one, that someone was the other. Because one thing we've talked a ton on this podcast about this year is the other, and how part of what it means to be nonviolent is to embrace the other who is so different than us and so scary to us. And just to me, the things that they really show in this chapter about the other being your neighbor is just, folks, you got to get the book just for that chapter alone. I'm going to stop there.
I want to be clear, just because I don't come off as by any way remotely self-righteous or which may be too late, but I hope not, or that I know. You know, one thing I always end up to, because then people will still read it and still push, but what if kind of thing. One of the things that I find myself finally saying is, I don't know ultimately what I would do. And I actually have a chapter coming out in a book that I'm writing where I claim to be agnostic. And by agnostic, I don't mean that philosophically. I mean that in the sense that it took me when you're raised in a very devout Christian ecclesial background, you know, being a Christian is just, it's the only thing you ever knew. And it took me years and years and years of studying to finally figure out that I may actually not be a Christian. And part of that is when I read 1 John, where Jesus says, if you claim that you know me, but you do not obey me, then you're a liar. Now, the word gnosis means knowledge, and so someone who is agnostic is without knowledge. So what I've had to come to the realization is that I very well may be without knowledge of Christ, because I'm not sure how good of a follower of his teachings I am. Matter of fact, I'd say I'm probably pretty lousy. Therefore, with much of Christian tradition, I don't think that belief is just somehow cognitively assenting to, you know, some, here's the 10 things you have to believe to be a Christian, or, you know, clap your hands hard enough and Tinkerbell will come back to life. Rather, as Kierkegaard said, the reason why it's so hard for people to believe is because it's so hard to obey. You know, in the early church, what it meant to be a believer was that you were obedient. And so I always say, I don't know. I'm probably agnostic because I don't know if I actually know Jesus because I don't know how well I obey Jesus. And so when it comes to things like this, you know, at the end of the day, if someone were breaking in and harming one of my loved ones, it could be the case that I pull out a 9-iron and take it across the guy's face. Now, if I did that, though, I would do it with the full knowledge that I was not obeying Jesus or following Jesus, giving a remotely Christ-like witness, and that would be problematic. So the only difference for me is I would never claim that somehow that would be justifiable via the teachings of Jesus. But I wouldn't be so pretentious and presumptuous to say, oh, you know, I would try to find the most nonviolent, creative way out, because I just don't think, you know, and again, here's something that I probably get from Stanley Hauerwas. Stanley once said, you know, the reason why I scream nonviolence so loudly is because I know I'm such a violent person. Yeah. That I have a community of people who can surround me and help me to be nonviolent. I'm just like, man, road rage gets me. So if we come to a real life situation, oh man, I'd probably have failed that test, but I would never try to make it, complicit with the way of Jesus. And so I always want to be clear about that. I am not the martyr out there, the one that's ready to pay the price. Matter of fact, of all things talking about, this is the one I hate talking about the most.
Yeah. Well, I have to be honest, Tripp. That's something we've said a lot too, is people ask all the time, what would you do? I'm always saying, well, I'm going to tell you what I think the way of Jesus tells me to do. But at the end of the day, there's two reasons I don't want to say what I would do. One is because I just flat don't know. Who knows until they're in that situation?
Even the person that's stocking their pistol, you know, in their drawer doesn't know exactly what they're going to do.
Exactly. The second reason for me is because I feel like if, you know, even as people who embrace nonviolence, that if we come up with this predetermined plan as to what we will do, it seems to me like we are completely ruling the role of the Holy Spirit completely out of our lives, so that we're not leaving an open door. I think of Jesus with the woman caught in adultery, and they cast her down, and, you know, they say, God, you know, Jesus, what do you want us to do? You want us to stone her, or, you know, do you want us to let her go? And then Jesus stoops over and starts writing on the ground. I just over and over have thought to myself, I don't think he knew in that moment. I think he was waiting for the answer, just like you and I were, waiting for God to quicken that to him. And so I think sometimes by us coming up with these preconceived ideas of what we're going to do, it's like we're almost completely ruling God out of the equation.
You know, one of my favorite passages is from the book of Daniel when, they're telling the boys to kneel down and worship. And, you know, one of the things they say is, you know, we're not going to do it. And they say, well, we have the power to kill you. And they say, well, that is true. We're not going to do it, even though we have no idea whether or not God will save us. We're still not going to do it. And it's a very interesting thing because, you know, it's such a heck of a story, you know, thrown in the furnace and there's, you see, you know, they're saved. They had no idea that was going to happen. They were just willing to go for that. And I think it's very right. You know, it's very interesting to me that there's this massive sort of segment in Christianity where when something bad does happen or whatever, people are like, well, God's going to take care of it. You know, whatever happens, happens because God has allowed that. Well, I wish they would, if you're going to think that, I wish you would go ahead and actually really believe that in all sectors of life, especially when it comes to things like violence. If God's going to take care of everything, then why are you pouring $14 trillion a year into the standing military? You know, you don't have faith in God. You have faith. Faith in nuclear weapons and a dollar bill. And that's what you have faith in. I'm not sure if Christianity can actually exist in North America. I just don't know what it would have to look like for it to exist.
Well,
I apologize. That's terrible.
Well, Chip, I have to say myself, you know, this has been quite a journey for me over the last year, you know, six or seven years of coming to embrace Christian nonviolence and really, you know, really coming to understand Christian anarchism and really finding myself, my heart identifying with it while I'm simultaneously living in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, you know, driving 2 cars and, you know, playing Xbox and watching TV. And, you know, so it's like at the end of the day, I look at myself and I'm always torn by this ideal that I have in my head as to what it would look like to actually walk with Jesus beyond empire. And yet I find myself smack darn dab in the middle of the empire and going, how the heck? It's kind of like Paul in Romans 7, you know, who will save me from this body of death? You know?
Right. Yeah. You know, and I think about that all the time. And again, I think that's why I go back, because I don't want to be hypocritical or a liar. So this is where I always come back and I go, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not a Christian, obviously, because my life is so affluent. I'm very bourgeois. I carry a number of banners around, but at the end of the day, I'm just as good of a capitalist whose capitalism is predicated on heavy forms of violence that make that possible. I actually had a couple of people over the other day from the Catholic Worker, Steve and Kim Baggerly, and Steve actually spent 9 months in prison, in a federal prison, with Philip Berrigan as his cellmate for nonviolent activities. Wow. Those are two people who have, I look at them, and of course they're far too humble to say this, but I look at them and I'm like, oh man, I can't wave this Jesus thing around anymore, because you know they live in an intentional community. It's not a lavish lifestyle. You know, they're actually living the kind of life that, unfortunately, even some of my good friends are writing about in books, who are sort of touring the lecture circuits and making, you know, a couple of grand at every stop. You know, people who I like dearly and who, hey, I don't mind if a university. But I also realize it's a little bit hypocritical, because here's my friend the Baggerlys, who are, you know, living, you know, in voluntary poverty with other people trying to help them out. And I'm like, yeah, that's, you know, down the road in the so-called bad side of town is where Christianity's happening, and I'm up here in my lovely, you know, 2-bedroom apartment, you know, my nice study right here, and I'm like, yeah, I can't criticize anybody for anything, because that long own eye is so massive that I should probably be quiet.
Yeah, you know, and that's the hard part, Tripp, is trying to figure out, and I guess because, you know, myself, not really, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Abraham and God saying, you know, I'm going to take you somewhere you've never been before. You know, you're going to go this way and you have no idea where you're going. You don't know what the scenery looks like. This is totally uncharted territory. And I feel that way many times in this, because I'm going, I would like to get there.
Right.
But how the heck do I get there from here is so many times what it feels like.
Right. And again, I just go back by Kierkegaard, it's so hard to believe because it's so hard to obey. But yet here in the United States, it's, you know, we've tried to make it, you know, it's so easy, you know, you know, it's just a, you know, rational, logical thing to do. Who wouldn't, you know, be a Christian? It's, you know, I've always thought that reading the Gospels was, you know, who would do that? I've never understood, you know, you have all these lovely Christian self-help books where Christianity is just going to improve your life and it's going to make you so happy and, you know, wealthy and successful, give you a reason to get up in the morning. And I'm like, well, I guess if you don't read Jesus, you know, not to say that there's not some kind of joy that comes with that. I'm not denying that, but I'm like, you read the stuff that he actually demands of and you're like, who can pull this off? You know, who can pull this off? That's why it's, you know, the early Christians were pretty good about saying, yeah, let's take this stuff literally and trying it. And then it didn't take long once Christians got in power to say, I was probably just kidding. You know, he's so full of hyperbole, you know, just exaggerating to make a point. He doesn't really want you to do that. He doesn't really think you should give away half of your goods or all of your goods or to potentially maim your body, you know, if it causes you to sin. Or to actually hate, even though that's the Greek word for it, your mother and father, if they're, you know, an obstacle to you being a follower of Jesus. He doesn't really mean those things. And I guess after about 1,500 years of saying Jesus didn't really mean what he really meant, then I guess you can pretty much have Jesus say whatever you want or need Jesus to say.
Ooh, Selah, man.
Ouch. That's all I can say when I think about that is ouch. That hurts, but it hurts so good. And, you know, God help us. God help us. One of the big ones that we've been asked, I'm going to skip a little bit to chapter 5 here, Trip. Lately, one of the things we've been talking about on our Facebook page, and personally something that I've struggled with a lot in understanding this, is the next question. Must Christian pacifists reject police force? By Gerald Schlabach, is that right? Schlabach?
Yeah, Schlabach. Schlabach. Yeah.
That question has really resonated in me for a long time. And I know you said this in your interview with Rachel Held Evans, and I almost have thought this verbatim. It was a question somebody posed to you, is, are we outsourcing our violence? When we say we fancy ourselves as believers in Christian nonviolence, and yet if something happens, instead of me grabbing my 9mm, I'll dial 911 and let a policeman grab his 9mm for me. If that's the case, if we're outsourcing our violence, what is our alternative? How do we embrace pacifism in a society where we can dial 911 and let somebody shoot someone for us?
And so let me say this, hopefully, that in case anyone turned it off yet or whatever. I'll be the first one to say I do not trust most Christian pacifists, myself included, because in our culture, it's just too easy to say you're nonviolent. I mean, it rarely actually demands much of anyone. Look, if I said I was a just warrior or if I said I was a Christian pacifist, for the most part, my life is going to look relatively similarly. Because, you know, a good Christian just warrior can be just as concerned about all sorts of issues related to social justice. But for the most part, I may or may not ever find myself in a situation in which I'm going to have to actively practice self-defense or defend another person. So I'm the first one to say with those critics that I think those who claim the banner of Christian nonviolence in North America, sometimes it's a little too easy, which is why, and I won't go into this because this is a whole different subject, but it's also why I attempt to live nonviolently with all of creation, which is one of the reasons why I'm a vegetarian and because of what factory farming does to the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And even though some people have lots of good reasons to disagree with that, part of that is because I like the taste of chicken, of flesh, and I feel like I need to actually have some sort of sacrifices in my life that where my nonviolence counts. And I think that's one of them, because if just being a Christian pacifist, I don't know if I'm actually living nonviolently or not, especially when I live in a culture that, you know, has nuclear weapons and heavily, heavily armed, you know, police officers, that's going to offer me protection whether I want it or not, kind of thing. And so I thought that was a great question, you know, how are we just not outsourcing it and what sort of alternatives? And without saying much about this chapter, for fear that my friend and my Andy Alexis Baker will listen to this and reprimand me greatly, because his dissertation is on police. He has a lovely chapter out there called The Gospel or the Glock, in which he talks about Christian policing, but he's talked about this a lot. One of the things, and Joe Schlabach talked about this as well, is we're always policing ourselves. Even the Amish practice forms of policing. Mennonites practice. It's what we call the shun. The ban and the shun. So I think that's inescapable of any, even the most utopian pacifist anarchist community. There's going to be certain parameters that places one in or outside of that community, and the question is always about how is that relegated? How is that practiced? Do you live in the kind of community by which, when there are certain obstacles occurring, whether that's a mass murderer or just, you know, somebody steals a tomato from the, you know, how do you negotiate those kind of things? And so, but we've had, you know, years and years and decades of like Christian peacemaker teams who that's their entire kind of reason for existing, is to provide these sort of alternatives of, here are some violent situations in this world. Now, how do I intervene in them in such a way that I can hopefully negotiate some form of peace. Now, are we going to be successful? Maybe, maybe not. But the police officer who shows up at the school may, or, you know, to protect, unfortunately, little kids, may or may not be successful either. You know, there's no way of guaranteeing this. And so how do we go about policing this so much violence in the world? Because, you know, it doesn't matter if you're the most fortified community on the planet, as we are with the United States, or, you know, if you live in an Amish community, no matter how many guns you have in your house, and you know, in the United States, violence is still going to occur. Or even if you get rid of guns, people are going to find a way to be violent. So that's going to happen no matter what you do. Although there's certainly arguments for how to make a society that may be less prone to violence than others, that I would love to talk about, you know. But so the question is, how do we creatively, peaceably police these sort of situations? So I don't know that the question is, a Christian pacifist says you got to get rid of the police, because I always, you know, think about how police officers are also referred to as peace officers. And, you know, one thing that my cousin who works, who's a police officer, you know, he says most of what he does during the day is adjudicate, you know, speeding tickets or, you know, of things of this nature, or somebody's cat got stuck in a tree. So he's helping him get the, you know, he's performing very valuable goods to the community. Now, of course, there's the potential for force that's behind that. But where are certain areas about how you can function and participate in this kind of way that may or may not require a lethal response? And I think that at bare minimum, Christians who are going to either serve in the police police department, or at least use the police as a means of adjudicating things, have to at least do so in a way where they take these kind of questions seriously. And I think that would result in a very different kind of response. But again, I don't know how to dictate exactly what that would look like. Primarily, it's been so rarely tried, but it is being tried. And again, I always turn people to Christian peacemaker teams to look at how they do these sort of things.
I think there was a couple of quotes in here that just really resonated with me as far as how this seems to, it seems like the whole nonviolence has to be holistic or it's nothing, because it seems like so many times we want to pick out just little parts and figure out, you know, some really pat answers to those little parts. But these quotes really kind of highlighted for me how this really does have to be a holistic approach. In the chapter, he says, "We often charge police with maintaining order in societies that are quite stratified economically and racially. The result is that to maintain order often means to cement in place a quite unjust disorder." And in relation to that, he quotes Dave Jackson as saying, "Christian communities that encourage simpler lifestyles with fewer possessions and that live in close proximity among themselves and practice reconciliation with their neighbors may also be deterring crime and reducing its very causes." And this just really hits back onto the thing we were talking about before, Trip, with just our whole American or Western privilege, where we can, you know, we can stockpile whatever we want, we can buy whatever we want, and what this causes is those who are less fortunate than us, to who don't have enough, because they're suffering while we're indulging ourselves, they're suffering from our overindulgence, that here they are with a greater temptation to equal those scales out themselves. Whereas if you have fewer possessions and you live in close proximity with your neighbors and you're sharing your goods, there's very little reason for anyone to steal anything from you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this is one of those areas, again, I wish Andy was here, because part of his work is to give a history of police force. And as he was noting there, it's really rooted in the fact of the ability for those in power to employ others to protect the things they have against those who are marginalized and who are powerless, and who, given the treatment of, say, Native Americans, African, Caribbean Americans, women, in the history of something like the United States, the police has been employed to protect those who are privileged. You know, just look at the 60s, you know, and you know, the ability of the use of police forces was to make sure if you needed to throw a German Shepherd on somebody demanding rights, you had the ability to do that. And that was, you know, within the realm of the law. And so there's this very interesting history where Andy is far less probably friendly to the idea of what it would mean for a Christian to be able to function as a police officer, giving its history as one of those who protect those against the people who have been purposely maligned and marginalized. Whereas, you know, John Howard Yoder would say something to the effect of, he said, you can never rule out a priori a Christian being in the police, in the military, even being a president. Yoder would just say, I just want to know how his convictions about the Prince of Peace would make him, how he would be a president. And obviously it would be a very, very interesting president that more likely would never happen. You know, any kind of president who would seek to disarm their nation state probably wouldn't last too long in office. No. A culture that loves, you know, it's very interesting with the whole gun debate. It always sort of floors me that Christians think they have a stake in that. I mean, where did they ever get this notion that, you know, the most important thing in their lives is the ability to own a friggin' assault rifle or a pistol or something like that? I'm like, where does that come from? And even if you truly believe that, you have to think, where does that originate? Who is narrating it? You know, you're a Christian in America, and so the question is always, does Christianity narrate the American identity, or is that American identity narrating that Christian identity? I think it's pretty obvious what's going on in that regard, and I think that's what's so great about Lee Camp's book, Mere Discipleship, where he really does that well, discusses that well.
Maybe I'm being crude here, but, you know, this is the image that comes to mind, is it's like, you know, as a Christian, because this has been the thing, I'm with you in that I continue to see, for instance, on Facebook, all of these posts from my Christian brothers and sisters who are just so adamant about their Second Amendment rights to bear arms. And, you know, the picture just came to mind as you were talking, Tripp. It's almost like we want to say that we're nonviolent, or that we believe in the way of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And to me, it's almost equivalent to like stuffing your pockets full of condoms and walking by a whorehouse and saying, I'm not going to do anything. You know, I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, how can we, you know, I think of Paul saying, don't make any provision for the flesh. And if we really believe in this nonviolent stuff, it seems like maybe one of the first steps would be to relieve ourselves of the option to bear arms in a situation like that.
Yeah, and there's a couple things I would talk about there. I love that statement. I'm trying to think of a book that I recently read, and it was a novel, but of which the guy is making this argument that that he doubts that any Christians exist based on the very thing that we're talking about there, where Jesus says, why do we worry about tomorrow? You know, you just worry about today, but look at the lilies of the field, look at the birds of the air, they have food, et cetera, et cetera. Why are you worried about tomorrow? And one of the things that he points out is Christians do everything they can to prove that they're worried about tomorrow. You know, you have a savings account. You know, that's what Dorothy Day once said, that the quickest way to discover whether or not you may or may not be an atheist is if you have a savings account. You know, people are starving right now, and you're storing money and goods away somewhere. And there's a lovely passage in the book of Amos about what happens to those nations who hoard their goods. And it's not a very lovely image. But we all seem to be greatly stressed about tomorrow, even though Jesus says, do not worry about it. And the whole thing about perfect love, knowing no fear. But we are the most fearful group of people that may have ever existed, despite the fact that we're the most well-protected people that ever exist. We're the most fearful-driven people that exist, whose just entire way about them inclines me more and more to Nietzsche, whose God is dead and we have killed him. Because in that regard, I don't know. And the whole thing with the Second Amendment, you know, one of the first things I try to get into conversations with other people is, when did that become the sacred document of all sacred documents? When did that happen? I mean, first of all, this was written by a bunch of wealthy white slave owners. They owned people. And when they said we the people, you can darn well bet they only meant white guys who were landowners. I mean, they certainly didn't mean women or anybody of color. And yet somehow that is the sacred document of all documents, maybe even more sacred than the Bible, because I think that probably more Christians in America actually may have read the Constitution, which I'm not 100% convinced that they've, you know, probably read the Gospels. So I'm just like, When did that become so important to us? And again, that goes back to the idolatry of the nation state and concepts of freedom, where I think Lee Camp's right. We got to let it go. And that's not to say that we don't have an interest in temporal kingdoms. Temporal kingdoms provide a lot of goods. And I think you can be a very good citizen and provide goods for temporal kingdoms. But once they trump, you know, the allegiance to the kingdom of God, that's when they become that obstacle that Jesus is always talking about. And you got to find a way to get let go of that.
So true. Man, there's so much good in this book. I just want to skim over one other thing and just get your take on it, because I know one of the questions that I've had raised a lot is the whole Romans 13 thing about being in subjection to the authorities. And you know, a lot of people have taken that as kind of, because in that passage, it says that God has established these authorities, you know, these orders and this kind of thing. Is this idea of people looking at that as kind of God's endorsement of those authorities, and even the possibility that God's endorsing you to be part of those authorities? Now, I know for me, a lot of what I've seen is that people make a real disconnect between Romans 12 and Romans 13, which seems to be kind of juxtaposing the believer to the nation state. But can you kind of speak to that and tell people what you think's going on in Romans 13?
Yeah, I love it when people bring that passage up to me. One, I first go, and as you said, I always start with Romans 12, let's not conform to the world. Read Romans 13 in light of Romans 12. Secondly, it does say demand for us to be subservient to the powers that be, and I think that's an act of humility on the part of the Christian to be subservient to these orders that sometimes operate radically against what it's to survive as a human being. So we are subject to the powers that be, and we're subservient, but we're certainly not meant to be necessarily obedient. You know, Peter is very clear, but Paul and Peter and Jesus are very clear that when you have to choose between following, you know, God or the laws that were created by humans, you always go with God. And that's what the law is. The law is always written by human beings. I mean, you know, that passage was used against Martin Luther King Jr. Hey, you know, all these authorities are ordained by God. Who are you to rebel against them? You know, these laws were created by humans and very corrupt humans at that. And he held them accountable to that. So I don't want to dismiss, you know, that tradition at all. And of course, the people who love to invoke Romans 13 tend to love to invoke it when it seems to serve their purpose. You know, so you'll hear certain conservatives love to use it when there's a Republican in office, but not when there's a Democrat. So if there's a Democrat in office, they all become Christian animals. That come from three. I always talk about, well, let's see, if that's what you think Paul means, that we're just supposed to blindly follow the government with whatever the government says, then Paul didn't follow his own advice very well at all, did he? He ended up being killed by the powers that be, and so did all the rest of the disciples or apostles. They ended up being killed by the powers that be. So he himself was subservient, yet he was quite disobedient to the powers that be. And that's one of the points that Yoder always made. You know, you're subservient, and part of what that means is when you refuse to give all loyalty to the powers that be, then you have to subject yourself to their punishment, which is often can be death. Or, you know, I think you got one disciple that got off lucky, and that was John, who was still exiled, you know. So Paul himself didn't follow his own best advice, if you take it to mean that. So it blows me away that you get from there to, obviously, God wants us to kill our enemies. I don't know how that happens. And finally, fourth, if that's the case, if you want to take Romans 13 to mean, you know, subservience to the powers that be, then the United States of America should never exist, because we only exist as a form of rebellion, you know, against British, you know, authorities. So the project of the United States of America was born out of an act of sin based on that passage right there. So it's quite bewildering to me how that passage is used to say, see, we can kill. It's incredible. So I enjoy talking about Romans 13.
It really is mind-boggling, Trip. It seems like we just... You know, the thing I'm realizing more and more and even in our conversation tonight, is that we have this tendency just to read what we want to read into Scripture. We don't perform as much exegesis as eisegesis and trying to really find our consumeristic, capitalistic, Western, militarized ways in Scripture to defend what we want to be able to own, what we want to be able to do with our own lives. And at the end of the day, Jesus, we become Jesus's Lord and we put him in our service and his words in our service, rather than submitting ourselves to the Lordship of Jesus and finding ourselves in his service, even when it costs us everything, which is really, at the end of the day, what Jesus promised, is that that's what it would cost us.
That's the only promise you get from him, is that if you take me seriously, you're going to, you know, look like me. And so that's what's, you know, my first book was actually on martyrdom. It was called The Politics, The Purple Crown, in which the litmus test for being a Christian in the first 300 years was very much so. If you're walking the path of Jesus, then the world, it's not going to be a secure life at all. And as a matter of fact, it may be the very opposite of security. They never thought to seek it, to seek security. And, you know, and it's one of those things that is often talked about in the 16th and 17th century, when the Catholics were killing the Protestants and the Protestants were killing the Catholics, and the only thing they could agree on was that it was a good thing to kill the Anabaptists. And so, you know, lovely Hauerwas quote there. And so a lot of later Mennonite scholars talked about how faithful the early Anabaptists were in the 16th century. But what actually even hurt the Anabaptists, the Mennonites and the Amish or such, is when finally by the 17th century, we started being accepted in society. And they found out, you know, people found out, well, they're pretty good farmers. They can grow food well, so they can participate in the economy. All we ask is that you be all quiet in the land, which is why to this day the Amish are very much, you know, sort of practice that. But the interesting thing was they were actually thriving and even growing more when they were being persecuted. But then they sort of started accumulating, you know, goods. And so it's interesting to read later Mennonites look back at that and think, it's so easy to just fall back into that worldly sort of way of being. And that's not to say you seek persecution. The matter of fact, the early church had to deal with that because there were so many people who were like, hey, I want to be a martyr, you know, kill me. And the early church was like, no, you don't seek it. You don't seek it by any means. But they considered martyrdom, to die like Christ, as an actual gift. And that's why you don't seek it, because their thinking was that in a world that is in rebellion against its creator, if you actually follow Jesus, trouble will probably come and find you. And that's where it's going to be. So I think one of the questions that Christians in North America need to ask is, why don't we produce any martyrs? I mean, we don't, you know, but you can go to El Salvador, certain parts of Central and South America, and you can find their churches produce martyrs. But we don't produce any martyrs. You can't even get people to stop shopping on the Sabbath. So it's highly unlikely we're going to produce anybody that's going to sacrifice anything else.
Wow. So much good food for thought. Guys, you got to go get this book, A Faith Not Worth Fighting For. And Tripp, let me just ask you, I understand that this is going to be an entire series, the Peaceable Kingdom series. What kind of vision do you guys have for the series? How many volumes are you looking at? What are some of the topics that we can expect in the future?
Sure, yeah. It's at this point, a three-volume series, but we're looking at expanding it. The second volume is already out, and the titles are all pretty similar. The whole premise of the series is, it's rooted on the little passage in Isaiah 11, the God's holy mountain, where, you know, the lion will lay down with the lamb, or the wolf will lay down with the lamb, and the kid's playing with the snake, and there's, you know, and here's this idea of, this is the heavenly kingdom, and when the Messiah is here and they war no more, this is sort of what it looks like. So we thought, well, what does it mean, like, if we can provide resources for what it means to somehow practice this kingdom so that people can have a vision for it? So maybe it'll be compelling to other people. And so far the three volumes deal with practicing nonviolence toward our enemies. The second volume is called A Faith Embracing All Creatures, practicing nonviolence to animals, whether that's in terms of food or clothing or entertainment? How do we think about, you know, the fact that God makes a covenant with the animals and you know, with Noah and all these things? And what does that mean? The third volume deals with the sort of larger ecological community from everything from, you know, it's our understanding that God created everything and God created everything good. And therefore, just as it is good for me to see the image of God in you, I still look at, you know, armadillos and octopuses and trees and lakes, and I say, wow, that's good. Why is it good? Because God created it. Therefore, I have some sort of responsibility to honor the gift that God has given us and to live in communion as much as possible with all of, you know, creation, not just one species on the planet. And so the whole series is an attempt to bring all of these questions together, and they're all done in the same way as this first volume, as, but what about this? But what about this? And we try to do that by looking in the other volumes at saying, when people are like, yeah, but what about this passage where it seems that God doesn't care for the animals or and those kind of things. So the series is trying to just give a more holistic approach, as you said earlier, that what it means to live peaceably is me not just saying, hey, I'm a pacifist, you know, but what does that mean throughout my entire life in relation to other living things, including the planet? So that's what we're trying to do. And it's incredible. We have Brian McLaren actually wrote the afterword. You were mentioning McLaren earlier. He wrote the afterword to the second volume. And the people we have attached to this project, I don't know how, like, I must have accumulated some good karma or something. I don't know how I roped in some of the people. I called in some big favors. But, I mean, as you've seen, I mean, from folks from Shane Claiborne to Brian McLaren, Carol Adams, Mark Bickoff, who's a guy who's co-authored books with Jane Goodall, writes the foreword for the second volume. Bill McKibben is writing the volume for the third. He's been in Time, you know, on the cover of Time magazine. We have some, and it's really interesting because I would say that the vast majority of names attached to it are Christian, of a variety of different Christian traditions. But then we have some non-Christians that are also talking about some of these things. And it's very, especially when you see the second, third volume, they're very ethnically and racially and gender. I mean, the gender diversity is fantastic, and we're excited about that. So there's a website. It's just called the Peaceful Kingdom Series. And you can go to the website and you can see the all the authors and people who are involved in the project. So we're
hopeful. Very, very cool.
Hopeful. Yeah.
Very cool. Man, I'm so thankful for what you guys are doing. I'm so thankful for you, Trip. Just love your heart, man. Love your thoughts. Love picking your brain. I could do this for much, much longer. However, this podcast, I guess, eventually has to end. Some of our listeners out there, they would stay on that treadmill for 9 more hours, but there's a few other that they've already arrived to work and they're sitting in the car. They're 10 minutes late to work right now. So I guess we're going to have to cut it off at some point, yeah. But hang on the line, Trip. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. We will see you next time on Beyond the Box. Great, great, great stuff. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. Trip, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Beyond the Box. And I look very forward to definitely more podcasts with you in the future. I just believe this is a very important topic and that this book goes a long way in helping us address some of the most difficult, toughest questions posed to Christian pacifists. There's so much more material in this book than we were able to cover. So I really want you to go out and grab a copy. And I would love for you to hook up with us on Facebook or on our website and for us to continue this dialogue. I have a feeling that this podcast might have raised more questions than it answered. And so I really want you to sound off on some of those questions, to give us some of your feedback or even your pushback. You know, we welcome disagreement on Beyond the Box. We just want this to be a safe place where you can agree, you can disagree, you can raise new thoughts and new ideas, and it'll be a really safe place where you can experience Christian hospitality in the form of hospitable dialogue. So if you want to do that, if you want to join that conversation, I would encourage you to either go to our website, which is beyondtheboxpodcast.com. You can leave a comment on this episode. You can leave an idea submission for future episodes. You can air your disagreements. Whatever you'd like to do there, please feel free to do it. However, I will tell you, if you're on Facebook, our Facebook community is amazing. And our Facebook community is really just a great place to dialogue about some of these really important issues surrounding living out the call of Jesus. So if you're on Facebook, check us out by going to facebook.com/beyondthebox. If you just go there, feel free to join in on any conversation, even if it's something that you see that was posted a month ago and there's already 10 comments and you're feeling like you're late to the party, please feel free to chime in and put your 2 cents worth out there. The way that we all grow is by dialogue. There's so many times in my conversations with you guys on Facebook and on our website that I've been challenged and I've had to really rethink some things. So I just want to thank you for that. And I just ask you to please feel free to not only comment on things that you already see going on episodes that you see there, but feel free to start your own thread. If there's a topic of discussion that you want to see started that you've not seen on our Facebook page, by all means, feel free to do that. If you want to subscribe to our Twitter feed, you can go to twitter.com/btbpodcast. And last but not least, if you want to leave us an audio comment that we can play on the podcast or that we can just hear your precious voice, which we love to do, please make sure to go to our website. You can do it there or you can dial our phone number. On our website, we have a little call me widget on the right-hand side of the screen, and you can click that and our answering service will actually call you back so that you don't have to call us. It'll call you back. You can leave your message. It's a really simple thing. So if you can go there and hit that call me widget and type in your name and phone number, hit submit, and our answering service will call you back. However, if you got a cell phone handy, if you're next to a phone and you want to give us a call right now, you can do that at 626-246-6269. That's 626-24-NO-BOX. So we'd love to hear from you. However you connect with us, we're just thankful that you do. And for those of you who don't connect, you just want to listen, I completely understand that, completely appreciate you, and just want to thank you for taking the time to listen to these conversations and to really open your heart and open your mind to some new ideas. I just really appreciate you guys, and I know I speak for Steve when I say that you guys have just been such a blessing and such a just a wonderful community in our lives. If you want to email us privately, maybe you don't want to leave a comment where it will be seen in public, feel free to do that. You can email us directly, either ray@beyondthebox.com or steve@beyondthebox.com, or you can just simply go to our website. You can go to the Contact Me page and just fill out that little form, put whatever you want to on there and submit it, and it'll go to both of us. So we would just love to hear from you. We just love to, I've gotten so many encouraging emails over the last couple of months of people that are listening and how it's blessing their journey and helping them in their journey towards Christ. And that just means a lot to me. And I just hope that this is something that you guys can gain from, and that together we can grow more and more to look like Jesus. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much, Trip. Once again, brother, I really appreciate your time. You are a blessing. Keep up the good work. Guys, we'll talk to you soon. Have a great week.